Hello, welcome to the gardening program here on Utah Public Radio. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and I hope you'll join me for the next hour of conversation about gardening. And our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or you can send us an email question, upraccess@gmail.com. And of course, we're going to be changing things around here a little bit because I'll bet we'll be able to get in the next couple of weeks an email address just for the gardening program. But there's one thing we're waiting for, and that's a title for the program. And I've had some great suggestions coming through. Today is the deadline. So if you have a great name for the gardening program, just go to upr.org, and there's a little link where you can submit your suggestions. And I would love to have those. And then come next week, we'll debut the new name of the program and let you know who was the winner for that. This week, we have our special guest, Jerry Goodspeed, who's USU's Weber County Horticulture Extension Agent. And he's on the line with us from Weber County. Jerry, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, and those who have listened to the gardening program when it was during Access Utah will recognize Jerry's name because he's well known to master gardeners and just general public for being such a help in Weber County and around the state. Jerry, I don't think I've ever asked you, what is your favorite part of gardening?
Holy cow, that's how long do we have?
Well, see, we now have 53 minutes left, so go for it.
You know, I've thought about this too. I'm a big tree person. I love trees, and so I guess, you know, the trees would be fun. But in reality, what I like about it is taking an area and improving it, and making it look better than it was. That's what I find joy in.
And I know for me, it's kind of. It's the whole year process. I mean, sometimes I actually enjoy weeding. Sometimes I enjoy the planting. Sometimes I enjoy watching the plants come up. I mean, there's not really anything. Yep. I don't like. So I guess it goes to what you're saying. It's that process of doing something to the landscaping and watching it change throughout the summer.
And sometimes you just like the imagination, the creativity in your mind to what the possibilities are, and then watching it come into fruition. And the whole from winter till winter, just about. Yep.
I do have to say I don't like the insect part of things, and although I don't dump a lot of chemicals in my garden, when you go out and see that the earwigs have been feeding on your raspberries, it's not a pleasant task.
No. No, I would agree with that.
Well, let's get off and talking about what we need to be doing right now. First, of course, in my mind was doing indoor plantings that need to be taken care of if you're going to do some transplants outside. For instance, I'm already thinking I'm behind the curve in getting my celery planted, and that's something that most Utahns I don't think have ever planted before.
That's probably true.
Have you had any experience with it?
We have. We've planted celery and done quite well with it. It is a long season plant, like you say, and especially up there in where you live, it's even going to be more important to get it a little bit earlier, get it started indoors, you know. And you know, we teach a class and we talk to people about starting things indoors and starting them early, and then we have to step back a minute and say, but wait a minute, make sure that if you're going to start them indoors, you have the proper, you know, lighting, the proper watering, heating, everything else, so that you can start them indoors.
Well, let's start right there then. So what should people have in order to be able to plant things indoors?
Well, you know, if best case scenario is you have a little greenhouse, but most people don't. I mean, that's the best case scenario. But
well, how little can you? Can you start with the? I mean, can you even plant cooler things outside if you have a cold frame to work from?
A cold frame or a high tunnel? You bet you can. Uh huh. Especially some of the cooler crops. And what some people will do, I know, is that they will start them indoors because the germination sometimes takes a little bit of heat. And once those seeds have germinated, then they'll place some lights right on top of them until they get to the point where they can pot them up and put them out in their cold frame. Such things like the celery, onions, you know, a number of those plants.
Well, let's look at the basics. So what kind of lighting is needed indoors? Does it change from plant to plant, or can you start with it with just some basic lighting?
Well, of course, the best lighting is the sunlight. Let's be honest, you know, everything else we do is just trying to mimic, and so a good south window, a good southern exposure, a good area where we get the plenty of sunlight is going to be your best. If you're going to go with fluorescence or if you're going to go with some other type of lighting, more important than anything else is the placement of it, in my opinion, is making sure that those lights sit right on top of your plants.
So literally, if you're going to use fluorescent lighting, it has to be right there on top of the plant.
Yeah, it does. So, yeah, it sure does. It can't. I've known a number of people that said, "Well, I have lighting in my kitchen," and so they'll put their little transplants or they'll try to germinate their seeds there and leave the lights on. But in reality, that really isn't much energy for them or in much light for them, and they will get leggy, and then they will be of no use to you. They'll die.
Do you have to have a full spectrum light, or can you use just regular fluorescent lights?
You can use just regular fluorescent lighting, but again, it has to be right on top of them. There's full spectrum lighting; they're a lot more expensive, and of course, they are better. But we have found that you can use other lighting just as long as they're, you know, when I say sitting right on top of them, within, you know, 2 or 3 inches of your plants.
So then, do you need to continue to raise the lighting as the plants grow?
As the plant grows, yep. Yep, you're right, Brian.
So then, depending on the plant, I mean, that's where you would have to maybe make sure that the plants are, that you group them together according to their sizes, because you're going to get things like squashes that have to be grown later in the year, but then you've got tomatoes, you've got things that are going to be taller, things that are going to be shorter, and those that are shorter are going to get less light.
Yeah, that's correct. And it doesn't, and it, you know, this gets kind of complicated because then it starts to determine, okay, what am I going to be planting? What's more important to me, the timing? You know, you had mentioned squash. You would never want to start squash this early because, you know, they germinate very quickly and they grow quite large very quickly, but your tomatoes, normally we're looking at the end of March, which is about a month away, to start them. And however, you know, what you had mentioned, your celery, and you know, I know people that will start Brussels sprouts and cabbage and some of the other crops, they'll start early on so that they can get them out in the garden and get a good full season for growth on them.
To germinate seed, do you need to have bottom heat?
It depends, and this is mostly just doing your research. It kind of depends on the plant itself. On a lot of them, yes, but on some of them, no. You know, and a lot of times when I know you get them, and I get them in those gardening catalogs that'll come in the spring, and there are some that you can look into them, and they will actually tell you what requirements are needed to germinate the different seeds. Or anymore, you can just go online and find that information out, what is required. Because even some light, some plants, not too many vegetables, but if you're trying to do some flowers and things, they're going to require light, and some require dark. And you kind of have to know that to get the best germination rate that you can out of them.
When you say they require dark to germinate? Some of those flowers?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Okay, so yeah. Like, which ones are you talking about? This is kind of interesting to me.
Well, when I say dark, what I mean is they need to be covered, whereas there are others you'll just lay right on the top of the surface where they do not want to be covered, and you want a little bit of light for them, and then they'll germinate that way. That's what I mean.
Generally, is it the smaller the seed, the less soil covering it would have?
That's correct, yep. Normally, you know, we say 2 to 3 times the diameter of the seed is a general guideline. That's just the rule of thumb that people use.
So if you're talking
about larger seeds.
Yeah, if you're talking about some really thin seeds, they're not going to go that far down into the soil.
No, they don't have that much energy when they push and when they germinate at first. You know, that whole seed holds all the energy that plant has to germinate and to get growing and get it to where it's established until they can start to take up nutrients and water.
And there are those plants that do not like to be transplanted at all, and we'll get to that here in a little bit regarding, you know, how large of a cup or size. I want to take a look at the medium that's being used in which to plant. I know trial and error showed me very quickly, don't use any kind of garden soil. You need to have a sterile soil to get them a medium to be grown into.
Yeah, you do. You know, and I tell most people, go down to a reputable place that sells potting mixes. And you normally, I don't know what you found, Brian, but I find you normally get what you pay for.
Yep.
They do have some good potting soils. They also have a seed starter soil, which is very light, so that you can use it to start your seeds and get them going. And then they have a potting soil, which will be a little bit thicker, so that the plants can anchor a little bit better, and that's what you're going to transplant them into once you've got them up and germinated. But, yeah, my opinion is you kind of get what you pay for.
So what do you look for in a good potting soil, besides price?
Well, you know, normally what I will do is if I can, and a lot of it's kind of what you have said, it's just come over experience as you've tried different ones, but the ones that I like to see is I like them to be loose. I like to make sure that there's some good drainage in them. And that's kind of, you know, you had mentioned you can't use soil that's sitting out in the garden. There's really no drainage when you put it into a pot. It's just thick. It almost turns into a cement block for those plants. And what you're trying to do is establish something that'll hold some moisture, have a little bit of peat moss, a little bit of organic matter in there that'll hold soil, that'll hold the water, but also drain well, because a lot of those seeds will just get too wet if you have a heavy soil. And some of the cheap potting soils are just too heavy, and they literally drown the plants.
So do you look for something with peat moss or perlite, or can you make your own?
I do both of those. I look for something that's high in peat moss, high in perlite or vermiculite, one of those. And it's lighter. A lot of times I have people say, well, the bag's not very heavy, so I'm getting ripped off. But that's kind of what you're looking for, is not a real heavy bag. If it's a heavy bag, that's usually telling you that it's moist and it's holding water too well, and it's probably not the best potting soil you're going to get.
So as far as containers, what should we be looking for? I mean, I kind of like to have the ones that have the domes, the trays that have a dome that I could put on them, because then they tend to hold the heat a little bit better.
The moisture.
Not all plants would want to have that kind of heat, but especially when it comes to doing things like the solanaceous plants, cucurbits, like squashes and so forth. They just love that heat.
Yeah, they do. And peppers, another one that loves that heat, but although they don't transplant quite as well. But, yeah, that's all I ever use, is just something with a dome on it.
So a
flat with a dome. And you can go to a nursery garden center, and they'll sell these little packs that'll have the flats with the domes. And they work quite well. Normally what we do is we will actually buy what they call seeding trays with the domes on them, so that they're a little bit shallower. They come in rows so that you can just have one row of one variety and another row of another one, so that it's kind of easier to organize it and keep track of what you have.
So
that's kind of what we like.
I've seen these trays with just little tiny holes that seem to be not bigger than the seed itself, and I just can't imagine certain plants doing very well in those. So what would you suggest to plant in there?
Those are, you're talking about the plug trays.
Yes.
Where we create little plugs, yeah. Well, we use those usually for flowers, not for vegetables.
Okay.
Usually we're using those for some of our smaller seeded flowers is what we use those for. Not a lot of vegetables, because most of our vegetables, with the exception being celery and onions, those are quite small seeds. Carrots, but a lot of people don't transplant carrots. They'll just put them right into the garden.
Yeah, that would seem like a lot of work.
Yeah, and I have... I've seen people do it, but I heard last year I had a friend who said, well, I transplanted my carrots this year, and I said, well, how did that go? And he said, well, probably not very good, because all of my carrots were 4-6 forked, where, you know, you had disrupted that taproot when you transplanted them, so they were not great carrots. So, yeah, we a lot of plants you just don't transplant.
Did those little peat cups, the little discs, do those work really well? Those are the ones they're flat, and then you put them in water, and then they expand up to,
yep,
I don't know, maybe
yep,
an inch and a half?
They work. They're kind of expensive for each, you know, you got one plant in each of those, but they do work.
So maybe
we have tried them.
Maybe for those plants that don't like to be transplanted all that that much. Maybe that would be something to look more at doing.
I think that's why they were developed, yep. Watermelon is another one that doesn't like to be transplanted real well for most people, and I've grown them in those.
Well, and I'm going to sidetrack here because you've gone to an area I've always wondered, and and I thought, you know, I'm going to quit planting indoors my squashes and my cantaloupes and watermelon, because it just seems like every time I do that, they just sit in the ground. Even when I don't move them very much, I only let them get to two true leaves and make sure they don't get too big. They seem to just sit.
Yeah, they do. They're not real happy when you move them around and change their surroundings and their roots. And it's been I've had the same experience. I just don't transplant those crops anymore. I'll use, you know, if I want to extend the season on something like that, I will plant it and then use a wall of water or a low tunnel or a high tunnel or something that's going to modify the environment around it instead of trying to move it from the house or from the greenhouse into the soil.
So if you're going to... Go ahead. I was going to say, so if you're going to start outside then with the squashes, you're not going to want to do that till what, May?
Yeah, well, up here we can... If you're not doing anything to protect it, yeah, about the first part of May is when we usually get those out as a seed. Now, you can transplant a lot of the squash. I mean, zucchinis do well. Some of the winter squash, I've had luck with transplanting, it's no problem at all. But anytime you start getting into those melons, you know, my experience has normally been I just like to do them from a seed, warm the soil, and if I need an extended season on them, you know, throw down a wall of water or throw down a hot cap or a cloche or something that's going to protect it.
Plus, you could always start early anyway by putting down, what would you do, clear plastic to warm the soil or more black plastic?
Yeah, clear plastic usually warms it a lot better. And some people I know will even put down their cloche or the wall of water or the hot cap or whatever it is on the soil before they ever do the planting. And this especially works like for things that like a warmer soil, tomatoes, peppers, eggplant, those types of things. Whereas you can, you know, too often we'll just put it right into a cold soil. And I think that's what shocks them more than anything else. And even with the melons and the cucumbers, I think if we could warm the soil up before we tried to transplant them, I think you'd even have better luck then, too.
Well, let's take a look.
That's what? I think that's what does more of the shocking to them, why they don't take off a lot of times.
So even if I was being really careful and not moving them around a lot, if I haven't warmed that soil up, even if it is in May, they, since they're coming from inside, even though I take them out for daily to get them used to the wind and outside and so forth, that may be what my problem is.
Yeah, usually that is what it is. It's that cooler soil. I've watched this is very typical with peppers because a lot of times they're available in the nurseries in May and your soil is still pretty cool and people will take them and transplant them and then what will happen is you move them from that warm soil that's probably 80 degrees into a cool soil that's probably 50 degrees, 55. Holy cow. Well, you know, you've jumped into a cold pool before. You don't want to do anything. And That's kind of the feeling I have with those plants is all of a sudden, well, okay, if this is how you're going to treat me, I'm just going to sit here and survive, and that's it. And,
so, you know. Maybe I've got a little more experimentation. I just have pretty much given up, but maybe I'll try that a little bit more this year. Well, let's look at
a couple with warmer soils, yeah.
Okay. And is it mostly just the melons that tends to be a problem with?
Peppers is the other one that I've noticed quite. They do a lot better if the soil is a little bit warmer when you transplant them.
Okay. Well, what should be planted right now? Are we too late on anything? I was thinking maybe the first part of March for things like broccoli, cauliflower, and so forth, but I don't know. What do you think?
It's kind of an odd year. We still have here in along the Wasatch Front, most people still have a pretty good snow cover on the ground. I've got a friend that religiously over the last few years always plants his peas the last week in February. Didn't this year just because he didn't want to shovel the snow off of the garden to go out and plant the peas. So You know, you're dealing with Mother Nature. Normally, the 1st of March, you're right, we're looking at peas. We're by the middle of March, we're looking at carrots. We're looking at some of the cold crops, the cabbages. And by the end of March, lettuces, you know, all of these other plants that we normally have in the ground, carrot. But, you know, it's you kind of have to, this is kind of that creative thing, Ryan, that I like is, okay, well, this year's going to be a little bit different than last year, because last year we didn't even have any snow on the ground, and I mean, we were planting some of those cool season crops pretty early, but this year we may have to back off a week or two. It's colder than normal. I don't know about you, but I still have snow on my garden, quite a bit, actually.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've got about 15 inches still on mine, so nothing's going to be happening there for a while, other than digging the carrots I've got out there.
And that's good. I mean, those are the best carrots in the world, by the way.
And I even tried, Dan Drost, USU Extension Vegetable Specialist, said you need to do your parsnips that way, because I've never been a parsnip eater, so I haven't sampled them yet, so I'll go outside here in the next couple of days and see what they taste like.
So you do have them out there?
Uh-huh. I have parsnips, beets, carrots, and cabbage.
Still out there.
Uh-huh. I dug a trench. He said, yeah, just dig a trench, and you stick the heads in and cover them up and put bags of leaves over everything. And so I'll let you know what happens. I know the carrots are going to taste great.
I've never tried that with parsnips or cabbage. I would be very interested in that. I've tried it with beets, but I'm not a big beet person, so I'm probably the wrong person to ask, because I didn't like them any better.
Well, it's interesting. The flavor does change with beets. A little bit when leaving him in the ground compared to getting him in the spring. My wife didn't like them either way. And I'm about the only one in my family that will eat them, so I don't plant very many.
Yeah, I've tried them both ways, and I'm like her. It wasn't my favorite thing.
Well, so as far as planting right now indoors, is it too late to do broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage?
No, I would... You know, you're not going to, you're usually looking about 7 to 10 days for germination and getting them up and growing, and then another week to two to get them to a two-leaf, three-leaf transplantable stage. So I don't think there's any problem at all. I know some of the greenhouses are right now getting them in. Just starting to seed some of them as well. So I don't think there's any problem with that.
What about those?
Those would be the ones I would look at.
Those things that I've been trying to do a little bit different, like maybe tried some sweet potatoes or some peanuts. You know, I just like experimentation here. Am I too late for doing things like that?
Nope. Normally what we've had luck with the sweet potatoes is that we'll just buy actually slips from either the nursery garden center or even we've done it on the internet where we've gotten the slips, the sweet potato slips, and actually grown quite good sweet potatoes. Of course, we have a little bit longer season here down along the Wasatch Front than you have up there in the valley, but I'll bet if you gave it some protection, and I know you do that, a little bit of plastic or something, I'll bet you could get them out there in April, end of April, and by October have some nice sweet potatoes.
So you've actually been able to grow them there?
Yeah, we do. We had some really quite nice ones last year because we had that really long growing season.
And are there ones that tend to love whatever heat you can give them?
I think they all do. You know, raised beds tend to do really nice for those sweet potatoes because obviously they're in the ground and the raised bed warms a little faster and creates a little bit better environment for them.
When you say a sweet potato slip, what is that?
That's what'll come. It'll have about one or two leaves on it with a little bit of a root system is what'll come. It's called a sweet potato slip. And... I don't know if you ever did this as a kid. You take the sweet potato and you poke some toothpicks into it, and you set it in a jar with some water in it, and it'll start to leaf or
mm-hmm.
root,
yeah,
and then leaf out. Well, those don't always make the best plants. So, and I don't know the exact process. This is something you probably have to ask Dan about because he's much more knowledgeable about this than I am. But I do know that if we start with a slip where it comes with the leaf and a little root system, we've had great luck with them. And, you know, it doesn't look like much when you get it, but we've put them in the ground, and as I say, they have grown quite well. But that's what it'll come as, one or two leaves, little leaves. When I say little leaves, they're probably, you know, 2 or 3 inches long, They're a sweet potato leaf, and then a little bit of a root system on it.
And you can get that at a nursery or just order it through a catalog, or both?
Both. There have been in the past, here on the Wasatch Front anyway, some people that have sold what they call the slips. You go into a nursery sometimes and you get the asparagus root or the rhubarb root, and they've kind of sold it like that, where it'll come in a bundle of 10. I know what it's like. It's like what you buy with a strawberry. That's what it looks
okay.
like.
And
it'll just have...
Is there a certain variety that's better than another, or just look for more short growing season?
The shorter season, the better, yeah. And I can't tell you off the top of my head any good varieties, sorry.
Okay, well, it's like one of those items that are grown a whole lot in Utah, so... But it is an odd thing when I think of names, for celery, for instance. You see Utah celery. I don't think I've ever seen a celery field anywhere in the state. Are they growing here quite a bit, or just further south?
Not that I'm aware of. Mostly it's just for the backyard. I think they tried it at one time. Again, this might be more of a Dan question, but I do know a number of people that grow them in their backyard and I even know a couple of greenhouses that grow them for people. They get them up and they transplant them out. But I don't know of any large celery producers.
Okay.
Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't any. I just don't know any.
Well, we've reached the halfway point of our program already. You're listening to the gardening program on Utah Public Radio, and Jerry Goodspeed, USU Weber County Extension Horticulture Agent, is my guest. If you'd like to join our program, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or send us an email question at upraccess@gmail.com. So we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back for the rest of the hour, and I hope that you'll call in with your questions or comments. So stay tuned.
You can have pets and still grow an indoor garden. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. As a cat owner, I've struggled with this issue for years. We love our pets, and they love to eat or dig in our plants. Start by selecting plants that are safe for your pets. Consult the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals website for a list of pet-safe and toxic plants. This will ease your worry and help you create a safe indoor garden. Next, adjust your gardening style to keep your plants safe from curious pets. Mulch the soil in large planters with chunky wood chips or, better yet, stones. I find the mulch keeps pets from digging in the soil and using this as a litter box. Try growing plants in hanging baskets and be sure to keep tempting long dangling stems trimmed or place plants on shelves or wall brackets out of the reach of pets. Homemade or commercial repellents may provide relief. Make sure they are safe for you, your pets, and the plants. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from Bonnie Plants, plant growers since 1918, dedicated to sharing a love of gardening to help people become successful and productive vegetable and herb gardeners. Information is at bonnieplants.com. Support also comes from the Logan Downtown Alliance and the Logan Film Festival, showcasing 48 documentary, dramatic, and animated films from around the world, March 21st through the 23rd. Information is at loganfilmfestival.com.
We're back with the gardening program on UPR, and Jerry Goodspeed, Weber County Horticulture Extension Agent, is my guest. And Jerry, I was just curious, do you have a favorite vegetable?
Oh.
We know you don't like beets that much.
No, not a big beet person. Well, to eat, it would be cauliflower, not to grow, because it just doesn't do great. But to eat, I love the things that can't grow. That's kind of odd, because I just think in Brussels sprouts, I know those a lot of people hate them, but I love them, and I love cauliflower. And both of those, I struggle personally growing, so I've kind of given up.
Well, okay, so let's go down that road. There are different types of what I would call cauliflower. I mean, there's the broccoflower, and some of the cauliflowers you see purple, you see orange. Do any of those, the coloring change the flavor at all?
No. I can't tell. In fact, you cook them, and it's pretty well gone. the color is. I've always kind of laughed at that. I've seen that Braca flower, and my opinion, it's just cauliflower that they didn't blanch. That's it. And then they sell it for more. And I think, holy cow, somebody knows how to market. So, I mean, it used to be you never see that just because people always expected that you wanted the nice white tender cauliflower and you didn't want to see any green on it. And so you blanch it up really nice and tight so that it's or cover it really tight so that it turns a nice white color.
Well, let's talk about that process because that's for a lazy gardener like myself. Sometimes that's not always the best plant to put in because if you've really got to be out there making sure they're tied up and keeping the sun from hitting it, that could be a problem.
Bingo.
What about those say that they're self-blanching?
And they do a pretty good job. It's still got some good color on it. And then the leaves will come up over the top. I just find that it's just a hard plant for me to grow because I'm not out there all the time. And so, you know, insects, I'll get some discoloration on it. And I don't get the big heads that you'll get into a cooler climate where you have cooler nights. And so, you know, I get to the point where I say, well, this is probably telling you too much about me. You know, I can buy that plant for X amount of dollars, and then I don't have to waste garden space on it, whereas I can grow something I really want to grow in my garden that I really like rather than wasting space on something that isn't going to be as good as something that I can go get fresh from a truck farmer or even from the store.
Well, and I know for me, I have to really watch it because if I'm going to grow cauliflower, I start it from seed, I can't let it sit too long because then the plant thinks, okay, it's time to grow ahead, and all I get is something the size of a pencil or whatever, and it just doesn't. It gets stressed out, and so it's got to be planted at just the right time. And I don't know. Sometimes I don't think it's worth growing it. Where with broccoli, if I do that, maybe the main head doesn't get so big, but then I get lots of side shoots that I can use.
Oh yeah, and you can be harvesting it for quite a while. I mean, you know, you get one good harvest off it, and then you let it sit, and you'll get some of those smaller heads, and they're just every bit as good. But with the cauliflower, I mean, you get one or it gets too hot for it, and it thins out, and it's just one of those ones I've said, you know, I'm not going to waste my time on you anymore. So that's just a personal decision.
Do you plant, even though you like them? Do you plant the Brussels sprouts yourself?
No, tried them too. They're a long season. I felt as if with the Brussels sprouts and all I was doing was raising aphids. So they just covered with them and I would try to control them. And I'm kind of like you. I don't like to use a lot of chemicals. I use very few. And pretty soon I decided, you know, it's another crop that I'm going to let somebody else mess with. And then I'm going to turn that area into, tomatoes or peppers or onions or something else that I know I can grow that I like out of the garden.
Well, I know some of the issue for people with Brussels sprouts is that kind of have a sulfur flavor that can be with them. How do you grow them so you don't have those compounds develop?
You know, that's probably going to be a Dan question.
Okay.
I don't know, Brian.
I had heard that it had to do with they don't like to have hot feet. So I'll ask Dan see if that's one of the things.
And I gave up growing them, so you kind of know what I think about them. But I love them. I mean, I love Brussels sprouts, but I can't grow them.
Well, let's look at fertilization and watering for starting seeds indoors. So you've planted these seeds and you water them in. Should there be any fertilization in that first watering or just enough to get them watered?
We don't worry about fertilization until we see green. And then we will use a water soluble. And what we do in the greenhouse and what I tell most people in their home if they're going to try to do this is every time we water, we have a small amount of water-soluble fertilizer in there so that we're kind of spoon-feeding them. The roots are quite limited in size. They're not getting out very far, and so it's easier for the plant. Well, anyway, we've had better luck where we just allow, every time we water, it has a little bit of fertilizer in it. And what we can do is, and it's hard for me to tell people how much that is. You kind of have to read the label and look at you know, what kind of fertilizer you're using, because there's so many of them out there. But it is important to make sure that it's a water-soluble fertilizer that mixes well, something like Miracle-Gro, Rapid-Gro, Peters. There's a number of them out there that you can use, and that's kind of what we do, and we've had very good luck with that.
Okay, and then how often should you fertilize it? Just with each time you water?
Each time we water. Mm-hmm. We just dilute it down quite a bit so that every time we are watering it, we're giving it a little bit of fertilizer. And the watering is the other trick. It's been my experience that most people overwater rather than underwater. We kind of have a tendency to think that a little is good, a lot is better, when that's really not true. So we kind of let the soil tell us when to water, and you know, we'll dab our finger into it. I tell some people, my watering people, you know, smell it. You can smell a soil. You know, look at the plant. As long as it's not laying over wilting, you know, it's still alive. But let the soil tell you. Just dig your finger down into it a little bit. Pretty soon you'll get a feel for just looking at it and being able to tell it needs water or we're still okay.
Are there some that require more fertilization than others to start out with?
There might be, but we treat them all the same.
All the same?
So,
okay.
Yeah, I've never thought about that. That's a good question, actually. I wonder if there are. There
well, if they
are.
All seem to be doing okay, then, you know, don't worry about it.
They could probably be doing better. That's a good question.
So as far as overwatering, what are some of the problems that you can see with that? I mean, obviously, if you're not watering enough, they're getting wilted. But if you overwater, what are some of the problems?
The biggest problem we run into is a disease called damping off when they get too wet. And then they'll get this rot right at the soil level of those small transplants, and they'll just flop over and die. And normally we see that when we have too much water, when people are overwatering it. And that's kind of the one thing we worry about, well, one of the things. And, of course, you know, plants need oxygen. Now, the roots need as much oxygen as they do water for respiration. And if they're not getting that, then you're just not going to see the growth that you should out of them.
So the damping off, is that a pathogen of some kind?
It is. Mm-hmm.
And then where is it coming from if you're using a sterilized medium?
Sterile soil, yeah. Well, in the homes, you know, in a greenhouse, you'll bring it in with other things at times, I suspect. In a home, if you have, and I'm not an expert on it. I don't know if it's airborne, if it's waterborne or soilborne, or where it's coming from But I do know that keeping other houseplants away from your plant and those types of things will help. Keeping it as clean as possible will help. Go ahead.
I was going to ask, how do you know when you're starting to have a problem? And then, and if you do see it, then is it too late?
How do you know when you'll notice that plants are, you know, you'll see them starting to come up, and then you'll see it turn kind of brown right at the soil level if you look real close. They're quite small, but you can see it, and then they'll just flop over, and they'll be dead. If you do see that, yeah, then we will normally dig those areas out, remove them, get that area out of there, and then dry out the rest of it, because it is a disease that requires moisture to thrive.
But it does sound like once you see it, it's too late.
For those plants, it is. Yeah.
For those plants.
Yep. Yeah, it is.
I did have a question about when to know when you need to transplant. So you've put in your cabbage, your broccoli seeds. They've germinated. How do you know when you need to transplant them, or should you just put them in a larger pot to begin with, so you don't have to worry about that?
Normally, what we will look for, it kind of gets back to this theory of, you know, sometimes we go into this venture with gardening and stuff with the preconceived notion that the plants are looking for an excuse to die. So if we look at them wrong, or if we, you know, if we do something, then they're just trying to die, when in reality the plant wants to live as much as we want it to live. And so all we're trying, normally before we transplant, we're trying to get it to a point where it can survive the move. And that's kind of different for different plants. Some of them we can transplant when they just show two leaves. Some plants will wait just because we know that they're a little bit tender. And some of that comes with experience. But normally, we like to be able to grab the plant and the root holds some soil with it so that you're not just ripping it right out with no soil. So if the plant has gotten to the point where it has some soil that'll adhere or that'll form a little root ball when you pull it out, then that's usually ready to go.
And so which plants tend to like to be pulled out versus those that would rather just you take the whole thing and put it in a bigger pot?
Which is which, you mean?
Yeah, well, for instance, could you pull out a tomato plant, or is that one that needs to stay with its what you're growing it in and just move it to a larger container and put more soil in
that
container?
No, we transplant tomatoes, no problem. We'll rip them out. We'll grow them in a seeding tray and then put them into a flat.
So those are more forgiving, sounds like.
Now?
What about your coal crops?
It kind of brings up a... okay, so there's two lines of thoughts here, Brian. I'm sorry, my mind is kind of going weird, but one of them is, you know, you had mentioned those little peat pots.
Mm-hmm.
And so what some people will do, and there's no problem with this at all, is you'll just direct seed into your... For instance, with a coal crop, you would just direct seed into your pony pack. And because it's going to grow large enough that you're not going to worry about it in your house. And if you want to put two or three seeds into each of those cells and then thin it out so that one of them is growing good, then you're not worried about transplanting it. Then you're just taking it from that pony pack like you would buy at a nursery and just planting it out. Some of the other plants, for instance, say you're going to do 100 tomatoes. Well, it's a little bit wiser then to go ahead and get a seeding tray, one that you can just seed 100 seeds in, and it takes less space, and it's easier then to get those 100 up and growing and germinating, and then moving them, transplanting them, when they get a little bit of a root system, and that's mostly what you're looking for is that root system, and then transplanting them into the pony packs or into the cell packs, and then later moving them into the yard. Did I make any sense there, or did I just...
No, that made perfect sense to me, and it must have made sense to someone else because they've called in with the question. So we have Jennifer from Vernal who's on the line. Yeah. And go ahead, Jennifer. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. A while back, I bought my granddaughter one of those all-in-one garden kits, and it comes with the dirt and a frame to put around it and all of the seeds and everything. And there were no weeds. And so I thought, okay, what's the deal? And I did some asking around, and somebody told me, because I was asking, how is it that you can go to the nursery and purchase a bag of soil that's going to be weed-free? And I was told that some people heat the soil up to kill the weed seeds and whatever else is in there. And I wondered, A, is that true? And B, does it damage anything in there that would be of help to the whatever you're planting, to whatever you're trying to grow? Have you heard about that? Basically,
well,
cooking the bugs out of the soil?
The potting soil itself should be sterile. And they do that a number of ways. One is sometimes they're just using sterile materials to formulate it. It means they've got the peat moss and the vermiculite and the perlite and whatever else they're putting in there, and they're beginning with it at the starting point. It's sterile. Now, how do they sterilize that? Some of it is naturally sterilized, and some of it, yes, they can steam it, they can heat it. Anything along those lines can kill, if it's warm enough, weed seed, pathogens, you know, diseases, insects, and things like that,
right,
without any problem at all. And yes, that is done. They can heat it up and they can sterilize it, and it is still good soil for such things as potting soils,
like,
and things. Yeah.
Well, would it work for tomatoes and the regular stuff that you grow
in a regular
garden?
As long
as it's, you're just transplanting them, right? You're just starting them off,
right, out of
getting
the
seeds up and
the
growing, and then you're
going to
transplant those into the garden. Is that correct?
What's that? Yeah, this is for, well, then theoretically, I wonder if there's a specific temperature or humidity that it has to reach, kind of like you have to cook meat to 165 degrees or whatever. if you had like a glass enclosure that, and you faced it south, and you, you know, shuffled the soil around in that, you could theoretically debug quite a bit of soil, right?
It's actually called solarization, and it's what a lot of people will do is they'll, I mean, you've heard of them taking clear plastic and putting it over the soil, especially in July and August, placing it over the soil. The soil will heat up 140, 160 degrees, which is warm enough to kill most pathogen, weed seed, and those types of things. And, yes, that is done.
Oh, wow, that's exciting, because that's pretty expensive to go keep buying those nice bags from the nursery. They're about $5-$6 per bag.
It is, but keep in mind.
Well, this is good to hear. I really appreciate it. Thank you. And hi, Brian.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for your call.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Now, I don't know if I would recommend reusing any.
Yeah, I was going to say, I thought I was explaining the process, not the reusing of it. I do know that that is done, that there are some nurseries, or rather there are some greenhouses that have what they call steam buckets. That's probably not the proper word for them. That's what we call them, but where they can seal it off. It's a large, like a big trailer. You fill it full of the old soil, and then you add steam to the bottom of it. It rises up through it. It raises it up to 160 degrees or so, and then that soil has been reused in some instances. But for a homeowner, I probably would not recommend that. No.
I mean, what else would you have than sticking it in the oven? It just seems like it's way too much work.
Yeah, it is. And I do know some people who have stuck it in the oven and cooked it, but then I ask myself, okay, but how about the potato casserole you put in there afterwards?
Yes.
I don't know. Anyway.
Well, in the last couple of minutes, I wanted to talk about if you're a beginning gardener and you haven't planted seed indoor before, what would you recommend? What would be the easiest plants, the most forgiving for a beginning gardener to start with?
You know, I'd probably say tomatoes, my own opinion, because you don't have to keep them in the house very long. They're very easy to germinate. Just add a lot of light. The other thing that we didn't really talk about is cooling them off at night, making sure, you know, I tell people a lot of times part of the problem is it's 70 degrees in your house at night, whereas you want to cool them down to about 50 degrees, slow down the growth at night when they're not photosynthesizing. But my own opinion would be probably tomatoes. If you want to do a flower, marigolds, you know, those two are both very easy to grow.
What about snapdragons?
Snapdragons, pretty easy to grow, too.
Yeah. I was going to say, they seem to reseed themselves very easily outside. So
they do, yeah.
So how do you get the temperature down? If you're only dropping it down to, like, say, 60 at night in your home, do you put it out in an enclosed garage or something, or?
Well, that'll help if you can drop it down to 60. I know a lot of people don't even do that, but, you know, sometimes take it down to a storage room, or if you have a cooler room in the house, you know, just move them into that room for the 8-hour sleep, if you will, at night, and then move them back up to where they get the light and they're growing. I just know that some people will just keep them in the warm place and not move them, and you do want them to cool down a little bit and reduce growth, at least respiration, reduce it.
Now,
during the nighttime hours.
Now, if you don't do that, you just know that they're going to just keep on growing, and you're going to have to adjust for when you put them outside?
Yeah, well, that, and they just don't. Then what happens is then they start using energy that they don't need to survive during the night when it's warm. They're respiring, if you will, and you just don't get the as much growth on them as you normally would expect.
Okay,
they're just not quite as healthy.
This is where I make a note to myself to turn off the bottom heat at night once they've germinated.
Once they're up and growing, yeah. When they're germinating, it's no problem. Don't worry about it. Just keep that up. But once they're up and growing, I mean, in the greenhouse, we'll cool them down during the day. You know, in a greenhouse, can get up to 80 degrees, but at night, we make sure that it gets down to about 55.
And then when, so with tomatoes, though, you're not going to want to start those until when? The end of March?
End of March, 1st of April, yeah.
All right. Well, we'll have...
And then you're going to have a... Go ahead.
Go. I'm sorry. I was just going to finish the program, but you've got one more comment.
Nope, that was it. That would be the perfect time for them.
Okay. Well, we've reached the end of our time, Jerry. Goodspeed Weber County Horticulture Extension Agent has been on the line with me from Weber County, and I'm sure we'll have you back in again, Jerry.
Well, I appreciate it. I enjoy it.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to end the program with a couple of gardening items, community calendar items. One of these I'm looking at is from the Cache Valley Master Gardeners Association and USU Cache County Extension. They're having a native and water-wise plant propagation workshop. It's March 14th at 6 p.m. or March 16th at 9 a.m. And it's at USU's Teaching Greenhouse at 1390 North and 800 East. The cost is $25, or if you happen to be a member of the Utah Native Plant Society or are a master gardener, it's $20. And the dates are subject to availability and are given on a first-come, first-served basis. And for more information, you can call 752-6263 or go to extension.usu.edu. And basically with this workshop, you'll be learning to start your own native and water-wise plants, seeds, cuttings, and there will be an informational book and other materials will be provided. But that's March 14th at 6 p.m. or March 16th at 9 a.m. at the USU Teaching Greenhouse on 800 East. In Washington County, Washington County Extension and the Water Conservancy District are holding raised beds and garden class. This will go over how to garden in raised beds and present the how-tos of creating your own raised beds. And for information, just go to dixiegardener.org. And then the last item is USU Extension is offering a fruit tree pruning demonstration class, actually two of them, is through the USU Botanical Center on Saturday, March 16th and the 23rd from 9 to 11 a.m. Learn how to prune apples, peaches, berries, and grapes properly to maintain strong, healthy plants and abundant fruit. Location and other information is at usubotanicalcenter.org. And again, today is the last day that you'll have to submit your suggestions for a name for the garden program. Just go to upr.org and you'll see a link there on our homepage to submit your suggestions. And then next week, we'll start out with a new title of the program. I'm also looking if you have any suggestions for topics or guests, things to do in the program. I'm completely open to your suggestions. Thank you for listening to the gardening program here on Utah Public Radio. The Gardening Show is produced by Shalane Smith Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. The Gardening Show is a production of Utah Public Radio. You're listening to KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.